Mr. Spence, you can.
Good morning. May it please the court. I have 7 minutes today, so I will be watching closely my super-duper yellow watch that I brought especially for the ability to keep on time. I'm Joseph Spence. I represent David Allen Cushman, the biological father of the child DAC Jr. Mr. Cushman's parental rights were terminated under Family Code 161001, Prin 1, and specifically there under subsections capital D, E, and Q. It's our position that there was legally and factually insufficient evidence for the termination under those sections. I'll begin very quickly with the two sections, subsections Roman D and Roman E, which are known as the endangerment sections. And I think to answer this question, the court need look no further than Justice Holman's opinion in N. Ray K.W., a 2004 petition denied case out of this court, 138 Southwest 3rd, 420. I believe the facts in that case are very similar to the facts in this case, and in that case, Justice Holman concluded that there was legally and factually insufficient evidence to support the endangerment findings. In N. Ray K.W., the evidence was that Charles, the father, was incarcerated at the time of birth of the child and at trial. The same is true here. In N. Ray K.W., the evidence was that the father was not aware of the mother's situation while he was incarcerated. And I think the same thing is true from the record in this case. If you look at Mr. Cushman's testimony in Volume 4 of the reporter's record, pages 22 through 69, nowhere is it indicated that Mr. Cushman, while he was incarcerated, was aware of what was going on back in Fort Worth, if you will. Of particular note, I'd also bring to the court's attention that in N. Ray K.W., the mother actually testified and said that she thought that the biological father was unaware of the situation. Here, I don't believe Kimberly Caldwell was even called, but the other two witnesses that the prosecution or the CPS called, Laura Zavala Clausen, who was the investigator, there's nothing in her testimony, which is in Volume 2 of the reporter's record, that indicates that Cushman, my client, engaged in any conduct that meets the endangerment requirements. All she said, ultimately, and if you look at page 65 and 66 of Volume 2, Ms. Zavala Clausen ultimately could only say, I believe that Mr. Cushman has endangered this child because he's incarcerated. And as we know from N. Ray K.W. and also Department of Human Services versus Boyd, a 1987 Texas Supreme Court case, evidence of incarceration alone is simply not enough to meet endangerment. Rose Jones was the CPS transporter, also testified. There's nothing in her testimony that indicates that Mr. Cushman was aware, can engage in any knowing conduct to endanger this child. Finally, in N. Ray K.W., Charles, the biological father, had a record of prior convictions as well, just like in this case. But again, as Justice Holman concluded, there simply was not legally or factually sufficient evidence to support the endangerment findings. Very quickly, to subparagraph Q, this is the provision that says if a parent knowingly engages in criminal conduct that results in a conviction for an offense and that results then in confinement and an inability to care for the child for not less than 2 years from the date the petition is filed. Our position is this. There was testimony in the record that DAC, that my client, Mr. Cushman, was unaware at the time of the offense whether his girlfriend was pregnant, the biological mother. And at one point, he initially did admit he thought that was the case, but when it was clarified, it's clear from the record, really it's undisputed, that he simply didn't know. And our position is this. Under sub Q, we think that a parent has to know that he is the parent of this child before conviction of an offense or commission of an offense can trigger sub Q.
Where do you get that?
Well, I get that from, one, the definition of that sub-Q and the entire scheme of 161001 talks about a parent must commit this act. And at that time, if he doesn't know he's a parent, or if he isn't a parent yet, then I think the whole scheme of sub-Q would not be met. And the reason for that is, if the legislature says, if you are a parent and you know you have a child, and with that knowledge you go out and commit an offense and get sent to the Do Right Hotel for 3 years, then that makes sense that it would apply. But the example I give, what, for instance, if you have a convict who committed murder and he's in prison for life, but as we know now, you have conjugal visits in prison. What happens if he fathers a child during a conjugal visit? Can the department the next week use Q to come in and say, you've committed an offense, it's incarcerated you for life, and so we're going to terminate your parental rights?
So you're basing your argument on the language in subsection Q of knowingly engaged in criminal conduct?
No, I'm not. And there's a case out there called Lewis, which went down that track. And the Lewis court said that knowingly means knowing commission of the offense. And I'm not arguing that. What I'm arguing is the whole scheme of Q, saying that a parent has to commit this, means that you have to know you have a child, so that the inference from the statute is, if you know you have a child, you shouldn't go out and commit an offense that's going to throw you in prison for more than 2 years, because you won't be a very good parent. But if you're not a parent yet, or don't know you're a parent, and you go and commit this offense, it shouldn't be held against you under Q.
Which case were you referring to that went down that knowingly engaged?
Your Honor, I don't have it in front of me, but I will, if it's okay, I'll submit a letter to you. But the name of the case is Lewis. It's an unpublished opinion, and I will submit it to the court.
Out of which court?
I don't know, Your Honor, and I apologize. It's right here in my stack of papers.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me that the legislature was meaning, when it wrote this portion of the statute, that the person must know that he was engaged in criminal conduct. I mean, that's an element of most criminal offenses, in fact, an intentional act and not some unknowing act.
Right, and I don't dispute that. I don't dispute that if you knowingly commit an offense, you meet that section, that test. But the question is a temporal component, what if you knowingly commit an offense before you're a parent? Can you take that offense and later use Q to come back and terminate the parental rights? And my position is, if you're not a parent or don't know you're a parent, the purpose of that statute, it's unfair to apply that
Well, the only problem I have with your argument is that you have to sort of imply it from the statute.
Well, I imply it from the
there's no element in the statute itself that expressly requires that the person who engages in criminal conduct must know at the time that they engage in criminal conduct that they were a parent are a parent.
And where I glean that from is right under 16001 paren 1. The statute says, before you get to all the subsections, it says a court can order termination if clear and convincing evidence, quote, that a parent has and then committed one of these. So that's where I'm drawing that.
Well, you can be a parent but not know you're a parent.
Correct.
And still meet the requirement of the statute, I think.
Well, and that's where I draw the argument. Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Rebecca Tillery, and I represent the appellant father, Mr. Jeffrey Caldwell. There are three issues today before the court regarding Mr. Caldwell. First, did the trial court abuse its discretion when it arbitrarily denied Mr. Caldwell's motion for continuance? The other two issues before the court deal with the factual and legal sufficiency of the evidence regarding the endangerment findings and the best interest finding. As to the motion for continuance, the trial court did abuse its discretion when it denied Mr. Caldwell's motion for continuance, when you consider the paramount importance of a termination proceeding and when you also look at the surrounding circumstances regarding his request. In addition, and furthermore, Your Honors, there was practically no evidence presented at trial or in the record regarding how the children's living conditions were such to warrant termination as to Mr. Caldwell, and there was very limited evidence as to how his conduct endangered the children. As for the motion for continuance, Mr. Caldwell's trial attorney made a motion for continuance for essentially three reasons. The first reason that she asked for a continuance was because she had found out some information relatively at the last minute, a few days before trial, that there perhaps was another court of continuing an exclusive jurisdiction. Now, that issue was resolved at a later point. However, the U.S. Supreme Court case of Unger versus Serafite very clearly states that a reviewing court must consider the circumstances presented to the trial judge at the time the request is denied. And at that point in time, the trial judge didn't know if there was a court of continuing jurisdiction. The issue had been raised. It was unresolved. And therefore, I would argue that was an abuse of discretion on the trial court's part. The other reason that Mr. Caldwell's attorney asked for a motion for continuance was because she wanted to have a little bit more time for Mr. Caldwell to dot all the I's, cross all the T's in terms of completing his service requirements. Now, this is where the grand irony comes in with this case, because much of the argument by the state, both at the trial level and at the appellate level, has to do with Mr. Caldwell's supposedly last-minute completion of much of the service requirements in this case. And yet, here we are at the beginning of the trial. Mr. Caldwell is asking for continuance just to give a little bit more time, and yet the trial court denies it. So it's a little bit disingenuous for the state to argue on both ends that it was okay for the trial court to deny that continuance, yet the big problem was there wasn't a lot of time between Mr. Caldwell's completion of the service requirements and the date of trial. The third and final reason that Mr. Caldwell's attorney asked for a motion for continuance was because CPS had failed to respond to some discovery that she had propounded upon them. And there was quite a bit of testimony about whether or not CPS had received this discovery requests and whether the fax number was correct. Regardless, Mr. Caldwell's trial attorney was forced to go into trial not having those discovery responses to her. So I would argue that when you consider what an incredibly important proceeding was before this court, I mean, the death penalty in family law, termination of someone's parental rights, that any one of those three reasons rose to the level of an abuse of discretion.
And moving, so what was the harm? What do you contend was the harm?
The harm in that, first of all, Mr. Caldwell's attorney had to go to trial without those discovery responses.
Well, I mean, how did it affect the outcome of the case?
Well, I think probably how it affected most significantly was that every person that the state called, whether it was a CPS caseworker, investigator, the ad litem, everybody made reference to the fact that Mr. Caldwell allegedly finished his service requirements somewhat close to trial. As trial was coming, he was finally getting some of these things completed. And so it appears that the trial court heard a lot about that, took that into a lot of consideration, when in reality, at the beginning of trial, Mr. Caldwell's attorney had asked for a little bit more time so that the court could have more time to gauge how he was continuing to improve his parenting skills and parenting abilities before trial. So I think that's how it ultimately affected the outcome of the trial. As for the endangerment findings, Your Honor, first of all, there was practically no evidence presented at trial as to how Mr. Caldwell endangered the children by putting them in a bad environment with bad living conditions. At the time that CPS first had their referral, at the time that CPS removed the children, they were not in the care of Mr. Caldwell. Mr. Caldwell had voluntarily relinquished them to the mother, Kimberly Caldwell, for a short period of time. And he'd also testified at trial that he had no reason to believe that was a bad decision. He had no reason to believe that she was using drugs. Furthermore, the state themselves, CPS themselves, continued to return the children and take the children back and forth from Mrs. Caldwell. So it's disingenuous for them to assert that Mr. Caldwell is guilty of negligent supervision for giving them to her when in the same time frame they were returning and removing the children from Ms. Caldwell. As for the endangering conduct portion of the termination findings, the most that the court, most that the state could point to was isolated, limited evidence of drug use. However, Mr. Caldwell testified at trial that he had been clean of methamphetamines for almost 6 months, that he had kicked his drug habit, and that he had taken the drug assessment that CPS had required of him. And furthermore, I think more importantly, there was no evidence presented at trial as to how this alleged drug abuse actually endangered the children. Just as, Your Honor, the Chief Justice wrote in the opinion of NRA DJJ, there was no evidence as to how these children were affected by this alleged drug use. The children were happy, healthy, on the honor roll. They were doing perfectly fine, great 10 and 11-year-olds, and there was no evidence that Mr. Caldwell ever used drugs around them, that there was ever drugs in the home. So I think even if this court finds that the drug use rises to a level of a deliberate and conscious course, I apologize. I see my time's up. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You can finish your thought if you'd like to.
Okay.
But I'm not going to let you go too far with it.
Okay. Even if this court finds that his alleged drug use rises to the level of a conscious course of conduct, a pattern, I think that the state fails in their burden to prove how that endangered the children, how that affected their emotional and physical well-being. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Windsor?
May it please the court. I never know how to start out on these things. I'm going to start maybe with the arguments we just heard, because I'm hoping they won't flee from my head before I get everything I want to say out. Motion for continuance. There was a written motion for continuance. It wasn't sworn to. There was no affidavit. There was no evidence presented. It was just a really quick, gosh, we'd like a continuance. Counsel did bring up the court of continuing jurisdiction problem. Can't explain why nobody had checked, or found the Tarrant County case, but once they did find it, that was resolved to everybody's satisfaction. The court transferred the case to that court, asked counsel if they had any problem with continuing with her hearing it, having it under the new cause number. Everybody said no problem. As to discovery, I didn't think that was Mr. Caldwell's motion for discovery, and I didn't really think that was the point of his motion for continuance. He certainly didn't show any particularized thing that he was deprived of from not having discovery. As to more time to complete his services, this is a refrain you hear in every one of these cases. It's sad to say, but everybody seems to wait in these cases until the very last minute. Trial is coming up. Oh, my gosh, I got to get the services completed. This is not someone who had been working his services all along. He didn't really even start working the services until October. Trial was set until November. So without any evidence on it, without a sworn motion, I don't think that the trial court abused its discretion by saying, no, this has been set. You knew this was coming. You've had your chance to complete your services. Endangerment. There's not a lot of evidence on the living conditions. I agree with that. I wish there were, but it's not there. But what there is evidence of is a history of drug use in this family that has repeatedly caused CPS to have to investigate. It, has sent both of the parents, all the parents, to prison at various times. I think it's slightly disingenuous to say you need some evidence. I mean, drug use is not something that parents need to be doing when they're caring for small children. It impairs your judgment. It's not a good home environment. It constantly exposes you to the risk of arrest. And when it happens, as in this case, and there's not anybody there to care for the kids, they wind up in foster care. That's not good. It doesn't give kids stability. Doesn't give them permanence. Mr. Caldwell had actually...
You don't think that there needs to be some showing that how the use of the drug has placed the children in danger? It's just common sense, is that what you're saying?
I think you have to look at all of the circumstances of the case. I don't think that you have to have that evidence per se, because I think you could call any social worker to say that. I think what you have to do is look at the actual life these kids were leading. And so, yes, you do have to have something, I think, but it doesn't have to be that, if that makes sense.
Well, so what is it specifically that you're saying?
In this case, we had a mother and fathers with lots of CPS prior history who had been incarcerated because of drug use. Mr. Caldwell actually had gotten custody, but he apparently got stressed out because of the stress of parenting, sent them back to the mom, who he knew had drug problems, had a history of it. When she did have drug problems again and the kids had to be placed elsewhere, he had drug problems. He couldn't, he wanted her to step up her games. He was tired of parenting and being the sole parenter. Well, then when she needed his help, he wasn't there. He was on drugs. He was homeless. He was in no position to take care of these kids. And that's the kind of evidence that you need in these drug cases. You need to see the actual way it's affecting this family. You don't need some sort of social work, you know, theory about drugs are bad. You need to see the practical impact it has on the lives. And in this case, it wound up that there was nobody who could take care of these children. Mr. Caldwell had the chance to take care of the children when they were removed from the mother, and he couldn't do it because he was homeless and he was on drugs. He didn't have a job. He was in no position to take care of the children.
But a lot of what you've described could be circumstances surrounding legal drug use of a parent who's addicted to prescription drugs and becomes incapacitated as a result and has to give their child to, you know, say the parents are separated and they're giving the children back and forth because of this addiction. And that's essentially what you're saying is the problem here.
I think that's true. Here we do have illegal drug use, so you have the added component of people being incarcerated. But if you have parents who have prescription drug use and they can't take care of their children, which is what is the most important thing, then yes, I think that would be sufficient to show endangering.
There wasn't any evidence of dealing, you know, in the presence of the children?
There was no evidence of dealing in the presence. When Mr. Caldwell was asked if he had ever sold drugs, he refused to answer the question on Fifth Amendment grounds. Going to Mr. Cushman, before I get too carried away and forget what I'm doing, on the imprisonment, the statute says it only applies to the parent. I think the whole statute only applies to parents. I don't think that's indicative that you have to have some evidence that you knew someone was pregnant or you knew about this child when you commit the criminal conduct, because you don't have to know. The knowingly part talks about the commission of the criminal offense. The whole statute applies to parents. It wouldn't make any sense if you didn't have that in there. I think that the evidence in the record, though, shows that he did know that she was pregnant with the youngest child, the Cushman child in this case. He answered the first time that he knew she was pregnant. Later, he changed his mind and said, oh, well, maybe I didn't. The trial court was entitled to resolve that conflict in the evidence, and the trial court did. For endangerment, you know, again, the idea that he was not aware of what was going on. Again, this is someone who has a long history with the mother. He had lived with her at various times. He had used drugs around her. She had the prior criminal conviction for drug use. Lots of CPS interventions, some of which he was involved in. And you know, most tellingly, he had actually had another child with her, and his rights to that child had been terminated. So, again, he knew that this was someone who had some problems. Now, his mother was apparently there to help, but, you know, and again, this is a dispute in the evidence. A social worker said that the grandmother of the baby knew basically said, I can't take care of the baby anymore, knew the child was going to go into foster care. Now, the grandmother testified differently, but again, this is something that the trial court can resolve the dispute in the evidence. We do know that by the time of trial, even with all of this going on, the grandmother had chosen to move into an assisted living facility and was unable to take custody. Mr. Cushman was still in prison, which is, you know, one of the grounds. We've got the endangerment ground. We've also got the imprisonment ground. He was incarcerated for the length of time, you know, from his conviction that was necessary. He has a long criminal history. This was an offense involving a deadly weapon. He had talked about he had committed parole violations before. So while he did testify that he was hoping he would be paroled, which would have been before the 2 years, the trial court was not required to believe that in light of his criminal history and in light of his prior parole violations and in light of the nature of the offense for which he was convicted, which was involving a deadly weapon.
And he knew he was a parent at the time he committed that crime?
The first testimony was that he knew she was pregnant. Then he later changed his mind and said, well, no, maybe I didn't know she was pregnant. But I think the trial court was entitled to resolve that dispute in the evidence, and I think that the trial court's, there's nothing to say that it's resolution of these credibility issues.
Well, do you believe that that's required, that's a requirement under the family code, that the person, that the parent know at the time they commit the criminal conduct on which the element, you know, for course of conduct is based, knows that they're a parent at the time they commit the conduct?
I don't believe that is a requirement, but we do have it in this case. So I think it's certainly something a court can consider because, you know, after all, in these cases, I don't think it's a requirement, but it's certainly something that if I were the trial court, I would want to look at in determining whether to terminate somebody's right. So I think it's just one more piece of information that the trial court ought to look at in determining whether to terminate, but I don't believe it's required.
Well, can you explain why you don't believe that in response to Mr. Spence's argument as to why it is?
I believe because, number one, the knowingly engage in criminal conduct, the knowingly goes to the criminal conduct, does not go to whether they know that it's apparent. And, you know, there are some criminal offenses for which you don't have to have a culpable mental state. So I don't think that the inclusion, maybe it would be a better argument if you always had a culpable mental state, I don't know, you know, but you could have reckless, you know, here it requires knowingly, you've got some like DWI where there's really not a culpable mental state. So I think the knowingly shows you have to knowingly engage in the criminal conduct. As far as the statute, the way it's written, as far as it being, it only applies to parents. The whole termination statute applies to parents. It wouldn't make sense otherwise. I don't think that wording in the way it is used is significant because we're talking about parents here. We wouldn't be here if they weren't parents. I don't think that that's a signal that you have to know that you're a parent when you, or have to be a parent when you engage in this. What really matters and what matters to the child is this person going to be absent from the child's life for more than 2 years? And, you know, and again, here we have someone who, I think he testified since he was 18 years old, he's 40-something now, the longest he's ever been out of prison is 2.5 years. That's certainly something the trial court can look at in determining whether on this imprisonment thing and, of course, on the best interest also. The court has no further questions. We will pray that the judgment's affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Windsor.
Your Honors, I would just like to briefly clarify a few things that were just stated by the state. I think it's very interesting that one of the first things that was said was all about the drug use in the family and the drug use of Mrs. Caldwell. That's really a good example of the running theme throughout this entire case. Mrs. Caldwell was the one who had the children when the referral was made. She was the one that was there when they removed the children from the home. And she's the one who has the repeated drug abuse, the repeated problems that started this entire case. And somehow along the lines, Mr. Caldwell got kind of lumped in with Mrs. Caldwell. And when you read the state's brief, I urge you to notice every time that the text of the brief is talking about Mrs. Caldwell and not Mr. Caldwell. So I think that's something just to point out, that while the state may have met their burden in terms of termination for Mrs. Caldwell, it simply doesn't add up for Mr. Caldwell, and I think he just got lumped in and added to the mix. In addition, in terms of the CPS referral history that was made reference to, I just would like to clarify that any CPS referrals that were made with reference to Mr. Caldwell, two were ruled out and one was determined unable to determine. So nothing ever had come of those, and CPS had closed those cases. The Chief Justice, Your Honor, had asked some questions about the connection between, if there was a pattern of drug use, how did that Where's the evidence that that actually endangered the children's physical or emotional well-being? And again, I would urge that there was no evidence. I think if the children had been suffering in some form or fashion, that upon removal, that would have been clear. Yet the record reflects no evidence of any abuse, no evidence of any neglect, no evidence of any inappropriate parent-child relationship between Mr. Caldwell and his children. In fact, the record is replete with examples of how well-loved and well-bonded the children are to Mr. Caldwell. They're 10 and 11 years old. They specifically asked their attorney ad litem at the beginning of trial to urge the court to grant the continuance so that their dad could have a little bit more time to finish the service plan. They want to go back with their father. They love him very much and are very bonded with him, and no one disputes that fact. It's an interesting juxtaposition that when they were removed from Mrs. Caldwell's home, that they were healthy, happy kids on the honor roll at school. And yet, at trial, there was testimony that since they've been in foster care, the boy, Cece, he had to have been hospitalized at Timberland for anxiety and separation issues, and that also the daughter, Elsie, she had been prescribed prescription medications and tranquilizers for her separation anxiety. So when we start going into the best interest factors in Holly versus Adams, it starts to add up that the children want to live with their father, that they haven't been doing as well since they've been in foster care. In fact, the CPS caseworker testified that they didn't know if the foster family wanted to adopt the children, and although they'd already been in four different foster homes, there might be another move on the horizon. So when you start looking into the Holly best interest factors, the evidence starts to add up that the best interest of these children are to remain with, are to be returned to their father. And even if this court finds that there is enough evidence to support the termination findings under the endangerment statutes, I would argue that there isn't enough under the best interest findings. And we know that there are those cases out there that reverses simply on the best interest finding alone. In addition,
excuse me, yes. Are all the children with the same foster parents?
Right now, Elsie and Cece and Mr. Cushman's infant son are in the same foster home. Yes. Right now, at trial, there was also testimony from the stepsister of Elsie and Cece, who testified that Mr. Caldwell was like a second father to her. He was her stepfather. He'd always provided for them. He'd been a wonderful father. Mr. Cushman, the other appellant, also testified as to Mr. Caldwell's parenting abilities. So again, there was just very little evidence presented at all as to his lack of parenting abilities or his lack of interest in being a parent to these two children.
What about DAC? Is DAC?
DAC is Mr. Cushman's infant son.
I understand, but you're making closing, I thought, for both, but perhaps not. But is DAC not in the same foster home as the other three children?
I understand he is in the same foster home.
He is in the same,
yes.
Foster? Okay.
I understand that he is. In addition, Your Honors, in closing, I would just point out that if you look in the record, in the reporter's record, on one of the very last pages, the attorney ad litem for the children testified that this is one of the most difficult decisions he'd had to make in terms of recommending termination for Mr. Caldwell, and that he'd really had a tough time and really struggled with it. So I think that speaks volumes about what kind of case this was and whether the evidence really got there for Mr. Caldwell. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tillery, Mr. Spence, and Ms. Windsor. We appreciate all of you coming here this morning to present your arguments. They're well done. It's a tough case. The case is submitted, and you're all excused. Thank you. We'll now call In the Interest of DMF.